Hello, I'm Julianne Good, and this is Psych One-on-One. Welcome. We are here to make psychology more understandable for tips for you and your family to make your lives easier. Tonight, my special in-studio guest is Dr. Gerald Lauren Fishkin, and he's going to be talking about his new book, which is called The Science of Shame and Its Treatment. So there it is, and beautiful book. I'm really excited about this book coming out. How are you, Dr. Fishkin?
I'm great, Julianne. Thank you so much for having me today.
Yeah, well, thank you for being on.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah, we met at a conference about 3 weeks ago and just hit it off, and it was wonderful. Dr. Fishkin was talking about oxytocin, which is one of those wonderful hormones that come into play during bonding. And it's that beautiful feeling of that rush of being in love. So we had a great conversation coming off the break, and we had a great lunch together, and it's been nice getting to know you. So can you tell the audience a little bit about your background?
Sure. I originally came from New York, moved to LA when I was 12. I had a little trauma. I came home one day living in Yonkers, New York, and I went to my home, and it was empty, and I went down the hill to my aunt's house. I said, what's going on? She said, oh, you're going to California tomorrow. So that was the first major trauma I ever had, leaving New York at age 12, leaving the family and all that behind. My background is interesting. I was going to be an actor. I studied acting and did act up through my sophomore year of college. And I realized, after you do your show and you strike the set, you got to start all over again. And I was looking more for something that would last a long time. And I was a minor in psychology, and I thought, this is great. I'm just going to change my minor to my major. And that was about 50 years ago. And here I am, just enjoying my life. I've been in clinical practice for 46 years this month.
It's amazing.
And I had a stint as a university professor and a college professor and a department head. But my true love is doing therapy and writing books. This is my fourth book.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
And we will talk about your new book that's coming out. And it's just fresh off the press, which is awesome. And we will also talk a little bit about your other books too, mostly about burnout, which is another fascinating subject that we'll have to bring you back on for just a segment on that, because that's really prevalent, I think, in the workplace nowadays too.
So, absolutely.
Yes. So what is your background in research that makes you an expert in shame?
Well, about 6 years ago, a colleague of mine had a problem with substances and went to a place called The Meadows in Wickenburg, Arizona, and I'd never heard of The Meadows, and I didn't know anything about shame. Shame is not a topic of psychology. It never really has been. It derives from 12-step and recovery groups. And so my friend went through this program for 40 days, came out, and it was amazing. About 5 years ago, I was having some burnout issues, and I wound up going to an outpatient program. The Meadows offered a program called Survivor 2, and it was a one-week training and therapy-type thing. I went through this thing, and it was amazing. I didn't know anything about shame, but apparently I had some. And when I left this program, after going through this amazing process, I realized, this is untapped. Nobody's really done much in my profession anyway with shame. And so I began to explore it. I began to explore what self-talk is, because really that's the part of shame that we hear, that negative, you're not good enough. Who do you think you are? You're not worthy self-talk. And I started with that. And I began to do a lot of library research and looking at my clinical background and the research. It took me into the depths of shame. Didn't know much about it when I started. I didn't know where it lived in the brain. If no one had written about where it lived in the brain, pretty much, until I got into the research of it and found that there really is a neurological nucleus, and it's in the basal ganglia, part of the limbic system, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Which is in the back of the brain.
It is. The basal basal, very basal part of the brain where the hypothalamus is. Mm-hmm. And that's they call it the seat of emotion.
Right. And the reptilian brain also.
Absolutely, yes. The reptilian brain.
Yeah, very ancient.
Yeah, but no one really put the correlation together between shame and self-talk mm-hmm. and the toxic stuff that comes from what I call traumatic shame or toxic shame, because I see that shame is directly related to the addictions. Toxic shame is. We all have shame.
Right.
But toxic shame is shame of another fabric here. Shame is, do you want me to talk a little bit about
it? Oh, please do, okay. Yes.
I think shame is something that we've never really wanted to talk about as therapists. It's that monster that lives in the corner of the room, or the corner of our consulting room, but we don't really address it. What I found over the years, Julianne, is that patients would come to my practice with addictions, and I'd get to a certain place, and they'd bolt. The minute we started talking about early life trauma history, and we started to discuss trauma, they couldn't deal with it, and they would bolt. And I would lose patient after patient that through that process, and never really understood why. I'm trying to treat it with cognitive behavioral therapy. It didn't work.
Why is that so? Because that seems to be one of the most therapies that's in the forefront. I mean, that's one of the things that they teach us in grad school is CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy.
You know.
And that's as a starting point. So why doesn't it work with shame?
Julianne, that's a great question. Why it doesn't work with shame is that shame, and toxic shame especially, but shame mm-hmm. is not cognitive. It's affective. And when we have a shame attack, let's say somebody says something to us and you know, exposes us, we want to hide, we want right. to disappear, right?
Mm-hmm.
CBT doesn't, you can't treat a massive abdominal wound with a Band-Aid
mm-hmm.
any more than you can treat toxic shame with CBT. It doesn't work. What I found over time, over the last 5 years as I was writing this book and working with my patients in a relational kind of way, that I didn't need CBT. CBT we can use later. After you get past the shame part and you get into the pragmatics, the functional part of how they operate day to day, you can use CBT. But CBT is toxic to shame.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work. And that's a major feature in the back of my book, why cognitive behavioral doesn't work. In fact, in the Netherlands, the Netherlands Psychological Association is suing the government because all they are providing with their insurance is CBT.
Are you kidding?
No, I'm not kidding.
Oh.
And I discovered that in a very small announcement, and I found, oh my God, this is amazing. They realize that CBT is not, you know, one size fits all.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not one size fits
it
all.
Isn't.
No,
it isn't.
We have to have that relational component. Because when we look at toxic shame, we find that the roots of toxic shame come from a breakdown in the relationship, in the bond between mom and child, whether it's a boy or a girl. And it's typically the mother, not the father, that we deal with when it comes to bonding. But when bonding is broken, there is no oxytocin. Oxytocin is what we call that bonding drug. It's,
right.
it's released from the posterior pituitary directly into the blood. It bypasses the brain-blood barrier, and oxytocin goes into the blood. Now, what is oxytocin? It warms our body when mm-hmm. we're connecting, just like you and I are right now.
Right.
I feel warm. I feel
oh,
great.
Yeah. You know, warm, fuzzy feeling.
We're relational.
Right.
Right? And,
yes.
and so in an exaggerated way, what I'm saying is we feel warm. Our partner feels warm.
Mm-hmm.
It's what happens. It happens with my dog and I. I mean, when I look at Cooper and he looks at me, we got that thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. But oxytocin is released. When oxytocin is not present early life, the child, the infant, never learns to bond. It becomes a very cold and sterile environment. And we need that bonding to make us warm, to fill us up, and to make us feel safe. And I think one of the things that I have seen over in the course of my clinical practice is addicts don't feel safe. They feel threatened. Everything threatens them.
Yes.
And that's because they didn't have that original safety.
Right. And then many times they have a chaotic household that they grow up in. And then they may also have one or both parents or other family members who are also addicted, or there's domestic violence going on in the house.
That's correct.
There's so many components, and I tell my clients this time and time again. It's like that attachment sets in from the time we're born until 6 years old, and there's nothing that you can do about it because you are under the ruling in the household. You know, whatever happened, you couldn't do anything about it.
That's
you did
right.
not have control over that.
And tagging on to that, there's an incredible sense of helplessness.
Yes.
And that sense of helplessness, like whatever I do doesn't matter, disempowers the child. So the child never feels whole and complete. And how that affects their self-worth and their self-concept is the child takes in all the negativity that they hear. And typically in these chaotic environments, it's not proactive, it's not positive. And so when we do therapy with addicted patients and we're working on toxic shame, most often we find that these people face their greatest fears. And what are they? Being abandoned, not being good enough, going crazy, losing a relationship, being a failure, that sense of emptiness because they've never learned to fill themselves up. So they never feel complete and whole. And then, of course, we have displeasing someone. They're fearful of that. It goes on, the list goes on and on and on. But what we can see is what that nucleus looks like is a sense of emptiness, a sense of I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough to fill my own space. So they look for relationships where they attach to. And here's where we have codependence taking place.
And getting into unhealthy adult relationships.
And typically they're all unhealthy.
Right, right. So you keep using the term toxic shame.
Right.
What is the difference between toxic shame and healthy shame? Because, you know, with healthy shame, then at least the person has kind of a chance to restructure their behavior. You know, and with toxic shame, so
okay,
what's the difference?
For me, the difference is this. We all have healthy shame, mm-hmm. I think. We all have shame. Shame lives
we
in the...
We hope.
Well, yeah. Well, unless we have massive brain damage in the limbic area,
right.
Then that's the horse of
or
another
antisocial
color.
Antisocial personality disorder.
Oh, absolutely. Right. They have no shame. Yeah. Or sociopaths. They mm-hmm. have no shame and no guilt.
Right.
And we'll get into the difference between shame and guilt, I hope.
Yes.
I hope, time permitting. Shame keeps us on the straight and narrow.
Mm-hmm.
Shame is for social benefit, really. It keeps us from making a fool of ourselves, right? It keeps us from feeling alienated because what we do is, it's kind of like the boundaries. It keeps us socially appropriate, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Toxic shame is shame on steroids. By toxic shame, and I defined it in the book as the addictions, or the gross personality disorders. Because what happens with toxic shame is no matter what the person does, they never feel okay. So it's not a specific instance of shaming. It's forever. It's not a single trigger. The individual with toxic shame is constantly triggering himself in that unhealthy way. When I was just talking about our greatest fears, every one of those greatest fears that I mentioned are triggered all the time in individuals that suffer toxic shame.
Yeah, and I have had clients, especially in group therapy, where they have shared stories about what messages their parents have given them.
Right.
Like total unworthiness. And I'm appalled. I I'm trying to keep this poker face and not have my jaw drop. But I mean, my heart just goes out to these people. It's just, how could you have survived through getting messages like that over and over and over where they start believing it? Because, of course, you know, your mother and father are almost like godlike when you're a child.
That's right. And what happens is in that horrible attachment process, the child comes to believe what the parent or the caregiver says about them. Now, what we find in the course of treatment is that when you unravel this toxic negative self-talk, it's really the voice of the other. It's never really our own. Yes, we can hear our voice, But when we look at the etiology, the roots of that toxic self-talk, that highly negative, dysfunctional self-talk, it's never positive. It's always, you know, it's you are this, you are that, you are this, you are that. And a person can't grow and be have a healthy, nutritious life living with that kind of thought process. And it was that that got me interested in the whole aspect of shame. No one ever really looked at the elephant in the room and attached the neurological aspect of it and the psychosocial aspects of it together, as I've done in this book. And hopefully my readers will benefit from these connections and see something that they have never really read or seen before. And I wrote this for the average person as well as others and therapists in training.
Yeah.
So did I answer the question about toxic shame? Toxic
definitely. Shame.
Well, then not only do we have the toxic thinking, but we have the toxic behavior. We have alcoholism. We have substance abuse. We have, you know, morbid thoughts and a lot of morbid behavior. And it's very repetitive, this behavior. Mm-hmm. It's like living in the box. These people never take risks. They are never risk takers in life. They live in a very confined manner, and usually it's like a rat, you know, on a wheel, or a hamster on a wheel rather. They just keep going in circles, but never really breaking the cycle of addiction or breaking the cycle of toxic thinking, which is really the important part here. And cognitive behavioral therapy doesn't do it.
Right, they have to go in and find the tool that works.
Absolutely.
So that they do not relapse anymore. That is the key component. So when we come back from commercial, let's talk about the differences between guilt and shame, okay?
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you.
Therapy Cable is the missing piece in the puzzling question, what is the role of the cyber world in healthcare? Therapy Cable has created a marketplace where healthcare finally meets technology in a consumer-friendly way. We use online technology to bring together various entities of healthcare in one central place. It's easy to access from any internet platform. We provide educational videos on topics like acupressure, medicine, psychotherapy, and yoga. You can confidentially use this information in the privacy of your home. You can stay connected to the provider of your choice or even see your provider in person. Get started today at therapycable.com.
And welcome back to Psych 101 with Julianne Good and Dr. Gerald Lauren Fishkin. We are talking about his new book. It's just hot off the press, The Science of Shame and Its Treatment. And this is for the general public and for clinicians. So this is a very informative book, and I highly recommend it. So
thank you.
Yeah. So what is the difference between guilt and shame? We hear those words tossed around, and I don't think a lot of people know the difference between the two.
Either they don't. In fact, guilt and shame are used coterminously, and it's wrong. Guilt is by definition an infraction. It's a breaking of a value or a learned rule, if you will. And when we have guilt, for instance, we walk into a 7-Eleven or something like that and steal a candy bar. Mm-hmm. Okay. Guilt would say you could get caught, you might feel anxiety. So that's not a smart thing, mm-hmm. Okay? Don't steal. But when we have a shame attack, a true shame attack, shame is always about ourself. Guilt is always about something we've done, but shame is always associated with who we are. When we have a shame attack, a couple of things happen. Most importantly, we want to disappear. Mm-hmm. We want to become invisible. We want to go away because it's really about who we are. And so I think that the differences between guilt and shame are fundamental. Again, shame is about who we are, and guilt is about something we've done.
Right.
They are not the same. In fact, as we talked about on the opening, shame lives in the brain in the basal ganglia. Mm-hmm. Guilt lives every place else. It lives in the neocortex. It lives in the hippocampus, in our memory areas. It lives in a lot of different places, but it doesn't live directly where the where the basal ganglia is and where shame lives.
Right.
Yeah.
So in your research,
yes,
where do you find that most of a person's shame comes from? Where does it start seeding in?
For instance, what do you mean?
Where, you know, because one person can be, they could have a criticism thrown at them.
Right.
And they can just go, well, no big deal. All right. Well, I'll consider it.
Right.
But maybe you're not right here. And another person, right, they'd be crushed by that statement.
Perfect. Great. That's a great question. And what happens here is that, as I said, when we can self-soothe and when we have ourself, when we have a fully, idealized and developed sense of self, we don't necessarily feel shame that much. Somebody could say something to us and we have good defenses, I suppose. Mm-hmm. When shame is triggered in someone that is an addict or has addiction problems or deep personality wounds, there's what we call limbic hijacking. And they go off to the races immediately. The limbic system takes over. And by then, they're just mush. And we're not going to be able to deal effectively. They can't deal effectively with who they are. They get stuck.
Is that where the panic attacks start?
Not only panic attacks, that's where the addictions come from. Right. They drink to quiet themselves down. They drink to soothe themselves. They'll shoot up, to warm their body. They'll take whatever to change their sense of self. Yeah. It really does affect their perception, and that's what they want to affect, is their sense of their perception of where they are and who they are. But it's short term. Mm-hmm. It's so short term and toxic, because eventually it's going to kill them. Like, we say that there aren't too many 70-year-old alcoholics. Many of them have hit the hospitals and they're dead by then. It's really an interesting event.
It's very sad, and it
seems
sad. And I work with addicts on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And I'm heartbroken by some of the young people that are coming in. I mean, the youngest person I worked with was 18 and a heroin addict, and had multiple years already at 18, mm-hmm, of drug and or alcohol use, and just, I mean, whatever they lived within, like a 5-year span, would have been more like 20, 25 years for somebody else.
Exactly.
It's PTSD to the max.
Well, it's that too. I alcohol affects mimic oxytocin. And that's a very important point, because people, we need to learn how to generate oxytocin. Mm-hmm. That's what I do as a therapist. In my work, I'm very relational. I have really, in the last 4 years since this writing this book and doing all my research, have discovered that the way I was before isn't really the most therapeutic way for me to work. I've become much more relational. For some patients, yes, I'm doing cognitive behavioral work because they need it. But for those that have suffered severe and traumatic early life experiences and toxic shame, I'm doing a lot of relational stuff. And for most of these patients, it's the first time in their life anybody ever talked to them about their childhood wounds, or the fact that they have a therapist who can come in and just, hang with them and
right,
be there with them in the moment, and not be afraid to be there, not be afraid to say, I'm with you, please let me be with you. Mm-hmm. Kind of thing. This is the work that you do.
Right. Exactly.
But I also find, and you work with the same population,
right,
these folks need a human being at the other end, because they didn't have it early in life.
Exactly.
They came from a toxic environment. They came from a traumatic environment. And all they know is trauma, abuse, violence, abandonment. These are the most horrible things you can expose a developing organism to, an infant to. It's horrific, because what is the foundation? What foundation do they have to grow and really enhance their sense of self-worth? It's toxic, and it's really, it really affects them throughout life. What I also find is that unprocessed trauma, mm-hmm, the trauma they bring, is directly associated with shame. And I find that this interoceptive affective desensitization. That's a big word, but it says that sometimes when we're doing treatment, we have to bring the patient into this early history to let them re-experience and examine it, mm-hmm. and then talk about it. What we also find is that the personality ceases to grow. While they may grow chronologically, affectively, emotionally, they cease to grow when their addictions began.
Exactly. And that's another point that I bring up with the people that I work with, is that whatever age you started getting into substances, right. I mean, the experimentation, I think a lot of children go through, at least, you know, junior high school age.
Of course.
You know, the experimentation is a little bit differently, but when the addiction really starts sitting in and their personalities change, their grades go down, their social
skills,
social skills get
lost.
That's it. They get frozen in time.
Well, they also collect with people of the same caliber.
Of course, and because they belong.
Yes, they have that sense of belonging that
right.
we talked about earlier.
Right.
They have that sense of identification, which they didn't have. And it wasn't instilled in them growing up. Mm-hmm. You're a part of a family. You're a part of love. You're a part of a network, if you will. No, that didn't happen.
Right. They were getting rejected by their peers.
Right.
They were getting bullied.
Right.
And they may be going home, right. and it's abusive. It's like, where do they find the love? Where do they start finding those moments that start connecting up with other people?
Well, hopefully, Julianne, they're going to find it with you. Hopefully, they find it with me. Yeah. Hopefully, they're finding it with other therapists like us who are doing compassion-based work,
yes.
some compassion-based work. And then we're going to get into what compassion is later. But what I really find is that for so many of these people, they are stuck. And I'll ask a patient coming in, and we're after we've met a few times, when they start to come at me affectively with something really negative and I can see it, I'll say, well, how old are you right now? I'll say, I'm 6. I'll say, absolutely, that's where it began. Dr. Fishkin, do I have to go from 6 to 45 now? I said, yes, we have to do this learning thing. We have to start to feel. We have to start to express. We have to start to grow, and you need to start to accept yourself as a human being.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
There was one EMDR session that I did, and EMDR is for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. It's research has shown that it's one of the best techniques for trauma resolution work. This young man had the hardest time trying to accept himself. And I just had him actually cross his arms and pat back and forth, and saying, I care about myself.
Oh.
And I just let him do that for maybe 2-3 minutes, and I saw his whole face change and his whole voice change, and it started going into his soul just from I could tell. And you can tell too. I mean, you're very seasoned.
Oh yeah.
And you can tell when they start going through the changes.
Right.
And hopefully something is going to plant itself in that beautiful, positive feeling of, you know what, I need to love myself first, and then
right.
really learn to love other people, because right. I'm with me 24/7.
And that's exactly right. And that's, you know, this is a major and critical component of this self-love. And I talk about it in treatment, not as a narcissistic self-love, because in our culture, you know, and especially in California, you say, I love myself. You're going to be looked at like you're an idiot.
It's superficial and false like that.
What I find treatment-wise is, as we go through the process, mm-hmm. that in lieu of the primary abuser, we take over and we become self-victimized. We abuse ourselves. That's the problem we have to break through, is that self-victimization. All that early memory, that early learning, I'm not okay, I'm not good enough. You know, if a child is abandoned, abused, negated in a very young age, how are they going to feel good about themselves? How are you going to get these affects moving in a positive direction? You're not.
Right. And then they take that energy out into the real world.
Yes.
And they expect other people to treat them like that.
Yes.
And when they don't, they're like going, well, you're boring, or I'm not turned on by you. Right. You're not going to swear at me. You're not going to belittle me. What's the matter here? I'm uncomfortable with you treating me kindly.
Like a person, like
yes.
a human being with warmth and caring and, you know, affection. And that is the essence of what we need to do. Now, of course, therapy is a lot more than just warmth and acceptance and nurturing. It has to do with, you know, identifying how they got to this place, this toxic place. And we have to go through all the changes, and they have to start to relive some things that are going to be very, very painful. But once they get through that pain, we can get into the shame pain game. We can then get into the clearing of the woods and begin to look at life in an open format and not this closed system that they had been living in for so many years.
Right, their own prison.
Their own prison.
Yeah. Yeah, and they can do it safely with us in the room.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the goal.
Yeah.
And then they take that outside and they take it into their relationships, because most of these folks have toxic relationships. Mm-hmm. They have one failed relationship or failed marriage after another, and they keep seeking the same thing. And when they don't get the same thing, they create it, and that is abuse.
Yes.
And what they find is they're heavy-handed, or the violence, or they find another drug addict to marry or to live with, or another alcoholic. And then we know what these alcoholic relationships are like. They're traumatic. They're highly up and down and unstable and miserable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And with some of those relationships, it's almost like they up the ante.
They definitely up the ante.
Because it's like, I can't, and part of them, which is really subconscious, it's like they're trying to get rid of the original events that happened, and they don't realize it. They keep attracting the same scenarios, the same type of people, you know, the same substances, and looking for a different result, looking for
right.
that resolution.
Julianne, they keep recreating the same sense of abuse and violence that they experience, thinking that that's normal. And of course, we know it's not. It's not the norm. I guess if you live in a ghetto, if you live in a place where there's a lot of daily shootings, you're going to become accustomed to living in a war zone. Then you have PTSD. And what I have found too, since I'm bringing it up, is many of these children that have been exposed to these toxic environments, these early life traumas, do suffer lifelong PTSD. And that's something we really have to come to terms with. It's the same effects as I do a lot of work with military folks coming and going to the battlefield. And when they come back, what I'm dealing with a lot of the time is PTSD. That is the sleeplessness, the reliving of the traumatic events. If they've lost their comrades, it's that sense of survivor guilt. There's a lot to PTSD, that sense of having to go back to the battlefield to finish the job. Well, it's the same thing that with these kids who are in treatment for toxic shame or abuse or addiction, is that they keep redoing the same thing, thinking that it's going to bring them closer to a resolution or an answer. And as you just said, it just pushes them further and further into their disease.
Right. Yeah, and then they go through some of those rehab conditions where they are being reabused. You know, I mean, there's, you know, especially if they are misbehaving or whatever, or not living up to the rules
right.
of the facility.
Right.
And so, you know, the clinicians, the house staff, they're all of a sudden they're quasi-parents again. And there they go. And then sometimes, you know, in situations like that, I have to sit there and remind the clients, okay, who does that remind you of? A lot of times it's like, that behavior reminds me of what my dad used to do.
Absolutely.
That reminds me of my mom. I'm going, okay, so maybe if you can learn that, okay, the lesson in this is like, there's probably going to be other people in your life that are going to exhibit that kind of behavior.
Right.
Are you going to buckle, and is that going to be a reason for you to use again?
Boy, that's a great idea. These triggers, when something is triggered in the brain of a toxically shamed individual, they believe that the reaction is going to be the same reaction,
yes.
as the original perpetrator, and that being a parent or a caregiver or somebody who, you know, was not there for them in whole and in full. And what we find is that their reactions are infantile, and they're going to be the same reactions over and over again. Now, when we start the process of treatment and they realize, well, we're not relating to them in the same way as they expect we are,
right,
we then have the beginning of change, or the potential for change. And therein, I think, is a really important piece here, is that we have to look at the triggers. We have to know what triggers these people.
And sometimes that takes a while to find out.
Right.
Because they've been living with it for so long. It's just, it's a habit. It's
right.
A pattern.
It is a habit.
Until you get in and start breaking that.
Right. But I want to, again, emphasize that cognitive behavioral therapy doesn't change these triggers. Because the reaction is coming from the old part of the brain, not the new part of the brain. And it's going to be a very base kind of reaction. It's when we have toxic shame, we're not thinking.
Right.
We're not thinking. So there's no, it's not like the guilt thing. It's how we are affected, our person, who we are. And I don't know if your viewing audience, well, I'm sure there'll be many of them who can identify and relate to what I'm saying, mm-hmm. is that you want to disappear. How many times have you felt that? Well, when you're toxically involved with toxic shame, traumatic shame, your drinking is going to help calm you and soothe you. But then again, it's kind of like walking around with a heart and lung machine. You'll always have to have your alcohol in order mm-hmm. to feel good. You'll always have to have that shot in the arm to warm your body, like oxytocin. You'll always need those drugs or that pot or that cocaine to quiet you down.
Yes.
Yeah.
Until you start connecting with other people.
Well, yeah, I think
that's part of it.
I think so, but I think it's connecting with yourself first.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I think the first connection has to be with ourself, with
yes.
our good self, with our child self, our healthy self.
Yes.
Yeah.
So when we come back, I would like to talk about the compassion component of this work and just kind of finish up and talk to the audience a little bit about what your unique perspective is on treating toxic shame.
Thank you.
Chicago School of Professional Psychology offers numerous psychology, behavioral, and health-related science graduate degrees at three campuses, Los Angeles, California, including branches in Westwood and Irvine, Chicago, Illinois, and Washington, D.C., and online. The Chicago School prepares students to meet the ever-changing mental health needs of society through classroom experience and real-world training. The Chicago School Counseling Centers in Irvine and Westwood provide caring, confidential, and affordable psychological services to individuals and their families. For more information, visit thechicagoschool.edu. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Psych 101 with Julianne Good and Dr. Gerald Lauren Fishkin. We are completing a wonderful session about his new book, The Science of Shame and Its Treatment. And who will benefit from this book, Dr. Fishkin?
It's interesting. When I sent the book out, I got a lot of feedback that teachers would benefit from this, school counselors, school psychologists. This is not just a vertical market for therapists. It's for most people who work with kids. And yes, the treatment orientation is important, but the identification of kids that were suffering traumatic shame or toxic shame, kids that were sexually abused, kids that, you know, had problems at home, who might have been doing well at one point and then experienced some kind of a horrible event and then began to withdraw. When we see kids suffering from this trauma, these traumas, we need to get our hands on them immediately.
Yes.
The concerns that I have to do with the 16 to 26-year-old shooters. Most of these kids were shamed. Most of these kids were bullied. Yes. Most of these kids came from homes where there weren't a mom and a dad to help them, to bond with them. Many of these kids, what we call loners, they were isolates. They were not part of a group, and they have tremendous amount of anger. So school teachers and counselors, anyone in the educational environment, therapists in training, psychiatrists, anyone that works in a therapeutic environment would definitely benefit. I think the general public would benefit from this book because it gives us an idea of how we should avoid certain things in life and what we need to build upon to have a fully enriched and happy life, a happy existence. Mark Twain, this is something that I read a long time ago, and it's something I carry with me. Mark Twain said that the fear of death follows the fear of life, that a man who lives fully is prepared to die at any time. Now, certainly we don't want to die at any time, but I truly believe in the idea of a full existence, a full life.
And it's possible.
And it is absolutely possible if we can take the barriers to our own existence down and fully understand what they are, that these early life traumas, these early life events that have cast a spell on us don't need to be indelible. We can change them.
Yes.
They are highly changeable. If the individual would first understand that they are not doing well and that they should put their, you know, put the call out for help, that if they find themselves depressed most of the time, withdrawn, not succeeding, and, you know, folks in their addictions, they're very hard to tap, as you well know. This is what you work with on a regular basis. I see this in my clinical practice. I don't get so many of the hardcore addictions as you do, but I have a lot of alcoholism and a lot of substance abuse mm-hmm. in my practice. And I find that when we get past the trauma part in the therapeutic aspect, when we deal with the early life trauma, they begin to open up and it's like a blossoming. Sometimes I can't believe what I see. Now, it doesn't always happen overnight.
Right.
But we're not using a mechanistic approach either. We're giving them the opportunity to road test what they feel and develop within the therapeutic milieu, if you will.
Yes.
Yeah.
So how does compassion come into play?
I think that's a very important word, compassion. I have really broken compassion down into two parts. Compassion is an affect. I think there are two affects in the brain. I think one is shame, and I think the other one is compassion. And when I break the components of compassion down, two things jump out at me, attunement and empathy. And you have to have both to have compassion. Now, attunement is something that is really kind of nonverbal, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not part of the cognitive process. But empathy is, I mm-hmm. think, because empathy means you know something about this other person and that you've got shared experiences. But attunement is something else. And I think attunement and empathy equal compassion. And I have a really nice chart in the book that shows that. And it really identifies and simplifies the concept that for compassion to exist, and it's never been written before, this is the first time, and I guess I'm breaking it out on your show, mm-hmm. and I'm so happy to do that, that to have compassion, we have to have empathy, and we have to have attunement. Now, we not only have to have empathy and attunement for the other, we have to have it for ourselves.
Okay.
And that's where it begins.
And can you get into a little more about attunement? Because
yes.
I'm sure that's a word that I'm sure a lot of people haven't heard of.
Attunement means we're tuned into who we are as okay. people. And attunement means that we're not going to say, oh, I love myself or I like myself, but... There's no buts with attunement. It's self-acceptance. Mm-hmm. And when we have self-acceptance, it's easy to understand how we can accept another, I think, because you can't accept somebody else if you don't accept yourself.
Exactly.
That it won't be in your physiological vocabulary.
Yeah. And self-forgiveness is huge.
It's the main thing.
It is.
We have to forgive ourselves. You know, there's a scene from Good Will Hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the most profound scene where Robin Williams puts his arms around Matt Damon and says four words. Do you remember the four words?
I don't, but you know, oddly enough, somebody had mentioned this about 2-3 weeks ago.
It's not your fault.
Yes.
It's not your fault. I get choked up and I can feel it right now. When I hear that, when I say it or I say it to someone else, that it's not your fault is the beginning of change. I think it's the beginning when they can fully understand it's not your fault. You are an infant. You are an innocent. What happened to you before the age of 18 is not on you. It's on somebody else.
Right.
I truly believe that.
You know, and the amazing thing is, there are a lot of traumatized people that I work with, and there are years wiped out from their memory bank. Yes. They cannot think back. What did I do between the ages of 4 and 10? I don't even remember. It was like it was a ghost existence at this point until they start having a little more sobriety.
Yes.
And start more self-acceptance, right. The compassion, the attunement, going through the hard stages at first, right. Because any kind of therapy is going to be probably difficult up front. And if it's not, maybe, you know, you're not really getting into it yet. And sometimes it takes a while to, you know, get the gears in or maybe the right therapeutic relationship.
Absolutely.
You know, it has to have the cogs have to fit into the wheel just precisely sometimes
right.
for the real change to come in and take hold.
What you said is profound regarding that the blank spaces in one's memory. And yes, addiction does cause that. There are, you know, those blank spaces are very much like blackouts in alcoholism, where the emotions were so great and the trauma was so intense that unless we can get the child to relive some of that and fill in those blank spots, then they can have a full history. Then there's continuity. Because what happens with addiction, early life abuse and trauma, is that the continuity is lost. And that's exactly what we're talking about here. We got to fill in the spaces, not to confabulate and make up, but to truly understand what happened during these periods of time, who were they, what they were feeling, what they were experiencing, so that they can fully accept who they are.
Right, and then let themselves fully feel the impact of how those early experiences may have affected them into adulthood
right.
and affected them into becoming an addict. It's so intertwined.
Yes.
Then until you start unraveling that for them,
right.
they don't understand it because they're just in survival mode. Many of them.
Well, we have to understand, too, that what does addiction mean? It means that we want to change our perception.
Right.
Because it's not, you know, for many of these people, most of these people, they don't have healthy defenses. They have toxic defenses. They have unhealthy defenses. They have defenses that don't work. In fact, these defenses work against them.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we want to do is teach them how to be relational, how to give and take without trying to change the way they think about themselves, that toxic way. Take their drugs away, take their chemicals away, and let them be, the way they were intended to be. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pure. Right.
Exactly. And childlike. I mean, I recommend to a lot of my clients, go out and have some fun. Go out and find, you know, some clean fun. Like, I went to a candy store the other night with one of my friends in Arizona. Uh-huh. I had a blast.
Right.
And it was weird because it was just like, I haven't been in a candy shop in a long time. We had a great time. So just something childlike that you right. can do that's healthy to get that carefree yeah. feeling back in your life again. So Dr. Fishkin, as we're finishing up, tell us just briefly about your other three books.
Well, my first book was, I worked with police primarily. Back in 1971, I was one of three police psychologists in the United States. And my work was primarily with police officers and training cops. At one point when I was planning to take a long vacation from my clinical practice, I was offered the opportunity to write a book. And I wrote Police Burnout, the first book. And it had a tremendous impact in the world. How cops burn out, the traumas and all. A lot of that was the original stuff for my shame work. But so burnout became my game. And from that book, from Police Burnout, I was doing a KFI interview one day, and I got a call from a firefighter who was burnt out and said, Dr. Fishkin, anything about firefighter and paramedic burnout? I said, no, but I'm willing to learn. I spent 6 months living in firehouses all around Southern California. And I then wrote that book, Police, Firefighter and Paramedic Burnout, The Survival Guide, The Role You Play, which is the first book on firefighter and paramedics burning out. Lots of interviews, lots of experiences working with these folks, and it became a real interesting and a real joy, and I still work with firefighters and cops today. I love working with them. My third book is called American Dream, American Burnout, How to Cope When It All Gets to Be Too Much. These books are all available through my website and through my publisher, and they're online and at Amazon and wherever you go to find a book, my books are there.
Okay, and your information is also on the screen. So
yes.
If anybody would like to order any of your books or contact you,
right.
we have that information on the screen also.
Wonderful.
So, yes.
And they can go to drgeraldfishkin.com. That's drgeraldfishkin.com, and it's all there.
Okay, and that number that you can call for the Chicago Distribution Center is 800-621-2736. Again, it's 800-621-2736 to order any of Dr. Fishkin's books. So thank you so much for being on. It was wonderful. I'm looking forward to having you on again, definitely.
Julianne, it was a pleasure being with you. I look forward to our next go-to.
Yes, definitely. Thank you. And if anybody would like to contact me, my contact is jgoode8@verizon.net. My office number is 562-209-1837. And my office is in Irvine, California and Santa Ana, California. Please contact me with any information that you have or anything I can help you with. I would be more than joyful to help you out with anything. If you do contact me by email, please put in the bar as Psych One-on-One, or you can contact me by Facebook also as Psych One-on-One or Julianne Good. So thank you so much for listening in. I hope you have a wonderful week and keep warm, okay? Connect up with somebody. That is so important. Go and love somebody. Love yourself. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other. Bye now.